Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, October 18, 2022. Georgia's Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who was in the middle of the contentious 2020 presidential election, debating a Democratic and Libertarian opponent challenging his re-election bid. The top topic, no surprise, election integrity. President Joe Biden highlighting the importance of abortion rights this election season, telling a campaign crowd in Washington, D.C., the first bill he would send to Congress if Democrats keep their majorities would be one codifying the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling, which the Supreme Court overturned earlier this year. We'll also hear from House Republican Tom Emmer about his party's agenda going into the last few weeks before Election Day. Russia continuing to pummel Ukrainian infrastructure with missiles and armed drones, knocking out an estimated one-third of the country's power stations. When it comes to China's military threats against Taiwan, a senior U.S. House Republican on the Armed Services Committee, Mike Gallagher, urging the Biden administration to preemptively deploy more U.S. missiles on the islands surrounding China. He calls that an anti-Navy strategy. And on this 50th anniversary of passage of the 1972 Clean Water Act, we'll get two perspectives from the White House Council on Environmental Quality and a senior researcher at the Heritage Foundation. Georgia has a couple of high-profile elections this year, including for U.S. Senator and Governor, and that has made the Georgia Secretary of State position, which oversees voting and counting of votes, very high profile as well, just like it was in the 2020 presidential election. The office of the current Secretary of State in Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, saying today that turnout in Georgia's first day of early voting, which was Monday, set a new state record for a midterm election, over 130,000 ballots cast. It's about 85% more than the last midterm in 2018. Secretary Raffensperger taking part today in a debate in his re-election campaign, facing Democrat Beam Wen and Libertarian Ted Metz. Here's a portion. It has the candidates asking each other questions. It's about election integrity. Starts with Brad Raffensperger questioning Beam Wen.
Do you agree with Stacey Abrams that the 2018 election was stolen from her, as she has claimed many, many times? Don't you think election denial is a threat to our democracy?
Well, let's be clear here. Brian Kemp won the election in 2018 and Joe Biden won the election in 2020. And I have always stood by the results of our past elections. Now, what is different between Mr. Raffensperger and me is that Stacey Abrams and I oppose laws that make it harder for Georgians to vote, including the 98-page bill that criminalizes handing out a bottle of water to a voter waiting in line. But what I find even more alarming is that Mr. Raffensperger continues to call himself a proud Trump supporter. And when asked about the lieutenant governor nominee, Burt Jones, who is a fake elector, Mr. Raffensperger, as recently as last month, described his interactions with Burt Jones as being great. We're talking about two people who tried to overturn the will of the people, and I believe that poses a greater threat than somebody who has been trying to fight for free and fair elections.
Would you like to respond?
Please. Well, I understand why you feel the need to distance yourself from those stolen election claims, but a Washington Post reporter recently stated, quote, "Abrams played up claims that the election was stolen until such tactics became untenable for anyone who claims to be an advocate for American democratic norms and values." I will also point out yesterday was the first day of early voting. We had 131,000 people show up to vote, almost double what we had for the gubernatorial race 5 years, 4 years ago.
Thank you very much, Mr. Raffensperger. Ted Metz, you get the next question.
All right. I would like to ask Mr. Raffensperger about the interview he did on NBC News the morning after the 2020 election, saying that 4.7 million votes had been cast and it was the highest turnout ever. And there was only 2% of the votes left uncounted. He said that Trump had over 100,000 vote lead and only 94,000 votes were left to count, which would finish later that day. And the count would not change the outcome just before the feed was cut. Then days later, 4.9 million voters were certified. And the question is, why did you allow the election results be so obviously
corrupted?
Please
get to your question quickly.
Why did you allow the election results be so obviously corrupted?
In the 2020 race, I made sure they had an honest and fair election, and every single ballot was counted. In fact, every single ballot that was counted through the scanners was then hand counted. We did a 100% hand recount to verify the results. And I'll stand by those results. But after the 2020 race, there was all sorts of misinformation, disinformation. And so I've been traveling all over the state, talking to you, the voter, to give you the information. Every single allegation that was raised, here's what the facts were. And I'll stand by those results, because at the end of the day, President Trump did come up short. And primarily he came up short because 24,000 Georgians skipped the presidential race, and yet they voted down ballot in other races. But we did a 100% hand recount. We audited the machines after. We checked every single allegation that was made. And those results were accurate.
Mr. Metz, would you like to respond?
Well, on that NBC interview, you said, we don't guess. 4.7 million voters, Georgian voters, and there was only 2% left to count. And you said the counting would finish that day, and the outcome would not change Donald Trump's victory in Georgia. Instead, you allowed a continued counting of phantom votes for 3 days, and over 200,000 more votes were added to the results, and that changed the outcome in Georgia. So I'm probably the only candidate on the stage that would end these election shenanigans.
Part of today's debate for Georgia Secretary of State, Libertarian candidate Ted Metz, the Republican incumbent Brad Raffensperger, and the Democratic candidate Bea Nguyen. Another topic that came up in this debate, abortion. A tweet by News Nation reporter Zayed Jilani explains that Bea Nguyen used her time to criticize Brad Raffensperger's stance on abortion when he was still in the legislature. It's not really a Secretary of State issue, but it shows that the Dems view abortion as their advantage, while the GOP views Stacey Abrams as their advantage. That tweet from the reporter Zayed Jilani. Stacey Abrams is a Democrat running for governor. Here's this part of the debate.
Mr. Raffensperger, in 2018, when you ran for Secretary of State 4 years ago, you felt it was important to tell Georgia about your anti-choice stance. And in fact, you touted the endorsements of two anti-abortion groups. And during your closing debate in 2018, you said, I have 100% rating from the Faith and Freedom Coalition. I'm pro-life. You wanted to talk about abortion back then. Why don't you want to talk about it now?
Well, your question shows that you fundamentally don't understand the role of the Secretary of State's Office of Professional Licensing. Our office provides administrative support for the boards. We don't select the boards. The boards run their shop. They are responsible for licensing, discipline, and rules. Job one is to know the job, and you don't know the job.
Ms. Nguyen, would you like to respond?
Since you don't want to talk about your record, I think it's important for Georgia voters to understand that as a lawmaker, you introduced a bill so extreme it would have outlawed all abortions and even basic forms of contraception, including IUDs and Plan B. Given the close ties to the nursing board, it's important that nurses and other healthcare workers decide if they want to trust a staunch anti-choice Secretary of State, and the women in Georgia should decide if they want to trust a staunch anti-choice Secretary of State.
Democratic candidate Bea Nguyen, Republican incumbent candidate running for re-election Brad Raffensperger, third candidate on the stage was Ted Metz, a Libertarian. Georgia Secretary of State debate hosted by the Atlanta Press Club and Georgia Public Broadcasting today. You can find the full debate and all of the debates this 2022 election season that C-SPAN is covering at our website at cspan.org. The issue of abortion also featured prominently in President Joe Biden's campaign speech today. It was at a Democratic National Committee event in Washington, D.C. at the Howard Theater. The president promising that if the Democrats keep control of the House and the Senate after the November elections, the first bill he will ask the new Congress to pass will be writing into law abortion rights that were in the 1973 Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade, a decision that the Supreme Court overturned earlier this year in the case Dobbs v. Jackson.
The only sure way to stop these extremist laws that are put in jeopardy women's health and rights is for Congress to pass a law. And I've said before, the court got Roe right nearly 50 years ago, and I believe Congress should codify Roe once and for all. Right now, we're short a handful of votes. If you care about the right to choose, then you got to vote. That's why in these midterm elections are so critical, elect more Democratic senators to the United States Senate and more Democrats to keep control of the House of Representatives. And folks, if we do that, here's the promise I make to you and the American people. The first bill that I will send to the Congress will be to codify Roe v. Wade. And when Congress passes it, I'll sign it in January, 50 years after Roe was first decided the law of the land. And together we'll restore the right to choose for every woman in every state in America. So vote. You got to get out the vote. We can do this if we vote. Folks, I also have a message for the young people of this nation. I've always believed that this generation, this young generation, represents the best educated, most talented, least prejudiced generation in American history. And that today, we face an inflection point. One of those moments that only come around every several generations, where there's so much change happening technologically, politically, and socially, that the decisions we make now are going to determine the future of our nation and the future of your generation for the next 30 or more years. And it only happens once every 5-6 generations. I know that you may feel like it's an added burden on top of all you've already been through, and this young generation, my grandchildren and children, have been through. I'm not saying you have to shoulder the burden alone. The task at hand and the task ahead is the work of all of us. What I am saying is you represent the best of us. Your generation will not be ignored, will not be shunned, and will not be silent.
President Joe Biden at a Democratic National Committee campaign event today in Washington, D.C. at the Howard Theater. Since the Supreme Court overturned the Roe v. Wade constitutional right to abortion, at least a dozen states have passed laws that have ended nearly all abortions in their state. And at the federal level, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham also proposing legislation to prohibit abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy, except in cases of rape, incest, or the risk to the physical health of the mother. Associated Press article adding this, for the White House, it won't be enough just to keep control of both chambers of Congress, already an uphill battle to be able to enshrine the protections of the landmark 1973 ruling into law. The Senate would need to abolish the filibuster, the legislative rule that requires 60 votes for most bills to advance in the chamber in order to pass an abortion measure with a simple majority of senators. But two moderate Democrats, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, support keeping the filibuster. For Republicans to take control of the Senate, they would need just one more seat. In the U.S. House, they need about a half dozen seats. Congressman Tom Emmer, Republican from Minnesota, chairs the National Republican Congressional Committee, which raises money for GOP candidates. He was interviewed by a Minneapolis TV station this past Sunday and says he's confident Republicans will get a majority in the House.
Well, the election is about security, Esme. Economic security and physical security. Democrats' failed policies, frankly, have made every voter worry about his or her economic security. Prices are up, paychecks are down. And then on the physical security, Americans are under siege. Democrats' pro-criminal policies have turned American cities into war zones. You look at New York City and the crime epidemic they're facing because of cashless bail. Esme, in Minneapolis, we've seen more than 6,000 assaults this year.
So crime is a big one that you're seeing.
It is. It is about the economy. It's crime. It's the border at all.
All right. In terms of what may be holding some Republicans back, do you see abortion at all with the overturning of Roe v. Wade as something that is hurting Republicans by just energizing Democrats to come out?
Look, Esme, Democrats are focused on talking to one group of voters, Democrats. Abortion is a key issue, obviously, with their base, but independents and Republicans, they're focused on the economy because that is the issue that matters right now to the voters. It's a gas and groceries election. Cost of living and crime, these are the issues, and that's why we're laser focused on those issues.
I assume that's what you're seeing back in the 6th District as well.
All across the country, that is the issue. People are concerned, you know, and they're all going to be asking themselves the same question when they go to vote, whether they're voting early or they're voting on Election Day, November 8th, Esme. Am I better off today than I was 2 years ago? The answer is clearly no. 8 out of 10 voters in the country believe we're on the wrong track, and it's time for a change. And I do know that it's going to change.
Congressman Tom Emmer, Republican from Minnesota, chair of the NRCC, National Republican Congressional Committee, interviewed by reporter Esme Murphy of CBS Minnesota, WCCO-TV Minneapolis, this past Sunday. Wall Street today, the Dow up 337, NASDAQ up 96, S&P up 42. Now to the war in Ukraine. This reporting from Reuters, Russia has destroyed almost a third of Ukraine's power stations in the past week. President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Tuesday as Moscow rained more missiles down on infrastructure in what Kyiv and the West call a campaign to intimidate civilians. At the Pentagon, the press secretary, General Pat Ryder, asked about what more can be done to help Ukrainians as winter approaches. Also a question to the press secretary about funding of Starlink. That's the satellite internet service from SpaceX that company founder Elon Musk has made available to the people of Ukraine.
We'll start with Lita Baldor at AP.
Thanks, Pat. Two questions. One, can you bring us up to date on any either ongoing negotiations, discussions, or just thoughts by the Pentagon regarding the funding of the SpaceX Starlink? Can you tell us whether or not this is still going on? Or I think there's still some question about Musk's tweet on Saturday as to whether or not he was actually saying he was going to continue to pay for it or not. Just give us an update on that. And then secondly, just more broadly, the airstrikes in Ukraine have been targeting their power, water supplies, et cetera. Is there any broad Pentagon thinking about what more can be done in order to help Ukraine protect its utilities as the winter approaches? Thanks.
Lita. So on Starlink and SpaceX, in regards to any statements that have been made by the company in terms of their business strategy or focus, I'd obviously refer you to them. I can say that the Department of Defense does continue to discuss various matters with SpaceX and to include Starlink, but I don't have any further details to provide beyond what we've already provided in that regard. In terms of airstrikes or strikes in Russia, in Ukraine, rather, and what they're targeting, we do continue to see them target, among other things, civilian infrastructure to include energy-related targets, power grids, for example. And again, this is not something new for Russia as they continue to inflict damage on innocent civilians, on civilian infrastructure, as they have failed to achieve their strategic objectives along the front line. In terms of why we think they're targeting those areas, I think obviously trying to inflict pain on the civilian society as well as try to have an impact on Ukrainian forces. But what we've seen so far is Ukraine be very resilient in their ability to get things like their power grids back up online quickly. In the meantime, our focus will continue to be on working with them to identify what their needs are, to include things like air defense, and we'll work to try to get those capabilities to them as quickly as possible, along with our international partners and allies to support them. Thanks, Lita.
Pentagon Press Secretary General Pat Ryder in the Pentagon briefing room. This from Reuters. Iran has promised to provide Russia with surface-to-surface missiles in addition to more drones, two senior Iranian officials and two Iranian diplomats told Reuters, a move that is likely to infuriate the United States and other Western powers. The Pentagon press secretary, Pat Ryder, was asked about this. He says he's seen the report but didn't have any further information. United Nations Commission today reporting that numerous war crimes took place following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, with most having been committed by Russian forces. The commission submitting a report to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Some of those war crimes, including rape, torture, summary executions. The chair of the commission writing, the impact of these violations on the civilian population in Ukraine is immense. The loss of lives is in the thousands. The destruction of infrastructure is devastating. In the 8 months since Russia's invasion, the United States has provided about $60 billion in military, economic, and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine, largely through bipartisan support, Republicans and Democrats in the United States supporting it. But the U.S. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, who may become Speaker of the House if Republicans get a majority, saying in an interview that more aid, especially if they do get that majority, is not a blank check. A question about this today to the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Kevin McCarthy did an interview with Punchbowl that was published this morning that talked about Ukraine aid and talked about how skeptical House Republicans will be of additional Ukraine aid if they are in the majority. And McCarthy said, I think people are going to be sitting in a recession and they're not going to write a blank check to Ukraine. They just won't do it. So I wanted to know if the White House is concerned about the apparent waning bipartisan support for additional Ukraine aid and if that would encourage, if that would push you guys to get more aid in the lame duck, even though you just got $12 billion in the CR.
So as you know, and you kind of laid it out, that United States has provided Ukraine with robust bipartisan support as Russia wages its brutal war against Ukraine. So we will continue to work with Congress and continue to monitor those conversations on these efforts and support Ukraine as long as it takes. We are going to keep that promise that we're making to the brave Ukrainians who are fighting every day to fight for their freedom and their democracy. We thank leaders across the House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats, as I've just said, it was a bipartisan effort, who are working with us to hold Putin accountable and support Ukraine to defend itself from Russia's war crimes and atrocities. So this is, again, we're going to closely engage. We're going to closely monitor these discussions. Don't want to get ahead of what Congress might look like next year. Don't want to go into hypotheticals. But again, we're going to continue to engage with Congress on this.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre getting reporters' questions today in the White House briefing room. Now to China. This from the Washington Post. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of speeding up plans to seize Taiwan as Chinese President Xi Jinping looks set to secure a precedent-breaking third term at a Chinese Communist Party Congress this week. The article goes on, quoting Secretary Blinken at an event at Stanford University on Monday, there's been a change in the approach from Beijing toward Taiwan in recent years. This includes a fundamental decision that the status quo was no longer acceptable and that Beijing was determined to pursue reunification on a much faster timeline. Article goes on, responding on Tuesday, the Chinese Foreign Ministry described Secretary Blinken's comments as an example of the United States reneging on its commitment to the One China policy, which acknowledges Beijing's position that there is only one China. That reporting from the Washington Post. Today, Congressman Mike Gallagher, a member of the Armed Services Committee, Republican from Wisconsin, called on the Biden administration to take a tougher military stance against China to thwart any potential invasion of Taiwan. Congressman Gallagher speaking today at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., an event covered by C-SPAN.
The reality is we will not be able to build the Navy the nation needs in the next 5 years. But what we can do within the Davidson window, however, is build an anti-Navy. And by anti-Navy, I mean asymmetric forces and weapons designed to target the Chinese Navy, deny control of the seas surrounding Taiwan, and prevent PLA amphibious forces from gaining a lodgment on the island. The first step in building this anti-Navy does not actually require us to defy any laws of physics, bureaucratic or otherwise, though technically it is rocket science. Now that we are no longer bound by the INF Treaty, we can surge long-range conventional precision fires in three concentric rings across the Pacific, the first island chain, the second island chain plus the Central Pacific Islands, and the outer edges of the theater, including Alaska, Hawaii, and Australia. In the first range, the first ring, we need shorter range anti-ship and air defense missiles, such as the Naval Strike Missile, long range anti-ship missile, and SM-6. these weapons will be operated by Army and Marine Corps stand-in forces, especially in the southern Japanese and northern Philippine islands. And wherever possible, they should be containerized so as to confuse Chinese targeting. In the second ring, we need extended-range maritime strike Tomahawks and other intermediate-range missiles. And in the third ring, we need longer-range intermediate missiles with advanced energetic materials in places like Alaska and Australia's Northern Territory. The point is that the PLA Rocket Force, which is China's anti-Navy, has fielded low-cost weapons to keep American ships out of the fight and target American forces concentrated in a few fixed locations. We must use this same logic against them. Building an anti-Navy that can sink PLA ships and amphibious landing craft in port, in the Strait, and on Taiwan's beaches.
Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican from Wisconsin, a senior member of the Armed Services Committee. He could chair a subcommittee if Republicans take control of the House. Today, speaking at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, he referred to the Davidson window. A Newsweek article writes that Admiral Philip Davidson, former commander of American forces in the Pacific, said the United States must maintain its military capabilities, prevent China from dictating the terms of the region's future. Davidson, who led the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command out of Hawaii for 3 years until April 2021, testified in Congress last year. He believed the Chinese invasion of Taiwan could happen by 2027. The Davidson window, as it became known, has been the subject of constant debate ever since. That from Newsweek. A 72-year-old U.S. citizen of Saudi Arabian descent, Saeed Ibrahim Al-Mahdi, has been sentenced to 16 years in prison in Saudi Arabia for tweeting, while in the U.S., criticisms of the Saudi government, and has been tortured while in custody, according to his son, who also writes the U.S. State Department had been both neglectful and negligent over this case. One of the tweets did reference Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered by Saudi agents in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. About that negligence and neglect, the State Department principal deputy spokesman Vardhan Patel asked about it.
I want to ask about the Washington Post report yesterday on the American Saad Ibrahim Al-Mahdi, who was arrested when he traveled to Riyadh last year and then sentenced to 16 years in prison. Can you just give a State Department response to that and your determination as to if he is wrongfully detained or not?
Sure. So a couple of things. First, we can confirm the detention of Mr. Al-Mahdi in Saudi Arabia. We have been following the case closely. We have consistently and intensively raised our concerns regarding the case at senior levels of the Saudi government, both through channels in Riyadh and Washington, D.C. as well, and we will continue to do so. We have raised this with members of the Saudi government as recently as yesterday, and it's something that we're continuing to pay very close attention to. Exercising the freedom of expression should never be criminalized. And as it relates to a potential designation, that process is ongoing. We are looking into it. There are a number of strict criteria that are involved in making that designation. So I'm just not going to get ahead of that deliberative process.
And when you say that this has been raised multiple times at multiple levels, what does raising it mean? Are you guys pushing for him to be released, for this prison sentence to be no more?
We are raising the issue of his detention, and we are raising it appropriately through the appropriate channels.
And then just one last question. Sure. The report noted that there was no State Department official at his sentencing hearing, which was earlier this month. Can you just explain why that was the case?
Sure. So the Saudi government offered no information in advance, despite the embassy's repeated requests for a confirm of any date. The court date had initially been scheduled for October 9th, this is our understanding, and on September 14th, the U.S. government sent a request to Saudi officials to attend the October 9th hearing. However, we did not hear back from the Saudi government until after the October 3rd date had taken place and the hearing had been rescheduled.
The State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel at today's briefing. Saeed Ibrahim Al-Mahdi is from Florida, and he was detained last year at the airport in Riyadh as he traveled to Saudi Arabia to visit family. He's been charged with harboring a terrorist ideology, trying to destabilize the Saudi kingdom, and supporting and funding terrorism, all for about 14 tweets over 7 years. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the C-SPAN Now mobile video app. A bipartisan announcement today about grants for community mental health centers in the United States. The funding coming from the bipartisan gun safety and mental health legislation that President Biden signed into law this summer after a series of mass shootings as Republicans and Democrats came together on that. Washington Times reports the $15 million in new funding is to supplement and expand support for certified community behavioral health clinics. The program received $300 million in September from other funding streams to establish new clinics or improve existing ones. The clinics operate around the clock and must provide routine outpatient care within 10 business days after an initial contact to prevent people from languishing on waiting lists, the Biden administration said. At a forum at the Health and Human Services Department in Washington, here is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Javier Becerra.
90% of Americans today are telling us that they believe the U.S. is experiencing a mental health crisis. 90%. There is nobody on this earth who doesn't know someone in America who isn't hurting. Today, we're talking about providing to Americans 24/7 support for crisis care. That's something that's only been available to some in some places. But depending on your income and your zip code, you could be totally out of luck. That's going to start to change. We're creating as well a very healthy partnership with our brothers and sisters in law enforcement so that we can work together to address the needs of a community and the challenges that we all face. Not all of them are challenges requiring a law enforcement officer. Some of them are just in need of a helping hand, a caring face. Think of this as a year where we launched big. 988 is now on board. It's the 911 for those who are about to do something they should not do with their own life.
The Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra. Joining him there, the two main Senate co-sponsors of this legislation, Democrat Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, and here is Republican Roy Blunt of Missouri.
After the tragedy at Uvalde, as is always the case, the first thing that almost everybody says is, well, the mental health system isn't working the way it should be. And we immediately talked to each other, and then we started calling everybody who was working on putting a package together to explain that we did have a system that was working. And Secretary Becerra, thanks for your leadership in this and your friendship and the time we all three worked together in the Congress and working together here. Assistant Secretary Delphin Rittman is doing such a great job on this. Administrator Brooks LeSueur, we've worked with on many other things, but now in your job at CMS, so critically important. Excellence in mental health. You know, treating it like mental health, like all other health, so critically important.
Senator Roy Blunt, Republican from Missouri, at today's event at the Health and Human Services Department in Washington, D.C., he referred to a plan that's already working. It was a pilot program, but now every state can apply for a grant to create these certified community behavioral health clinics. A press release put out by Senator Blunt referring to what's going on today, saying that Department of Health and Human Services found that people who receive care at these behavioral health clinics had 72% reduction in hospitalization, 69% reduction in visits to the emergency room, 41% decrease in homelessness, and 61% less time in jails. Also, 84% of these clinics either already provide direct services on site at elementary, middle, and high schools or plan to in the future. That from the press release from Senator Blunt. It was 50 years ago today that Congress finalized and passed the Clean Water Act. It became one of the first and most influential modern environmental laws. A celebration held today on the banks of the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland on Merwin's Wharf. An article at WKYC-TV, an NBC affiliate in Cleveland, writes, "Why Cleveland? The Cuyahoga River was among the polluted sites across the country that inspired the 1972 passage of the Clean Water Act. Organizers cited the river's history of pollution so serious that it infamously caught fire on numerous occasions." Representing the White House at today's event in Cleveland, Brenda Mallory, who chairs the White House Council on Environmental Quality.
While the Cuyahoga River no longer catches fire, in fact, it is now so clean that its waters are once again fishable and swimmable, we have a planet on fire. Clean water has always been a shared resource that we ignore at our peril. But this is especially true as we confront climate change. We can't separate the need for clean water from other pressing issues we face, like climate change and environmental injustice. Nor can we separate clean water from the opportunities that those challenges present. President Biden often talks about the United States as a nation of possibilities. Many of those possibilities are rooted in access to clean water and a healthy community. The next 50 years of environmentalism centers in so many ways around clean water. And it can work together to, and if we work together to steward this resource, the investment pays off in a healthy environment, in a healthy people, and in a healthy economy. But the next 50 years of environmentalism must also include a more holistic picture. It's about clean water and climate change, clean water and environmental justice, clean water and equitable green and blue space, clean water and economic development. So President Biden recognizes the opportunity we have at this moment, and he knows that if we do this right, we can protect lives and livelihoods while making our communities more resilient to the impacts of climate change. I want to focus for 1 minute on that nexus of clean water and environmental justice, because President Biden has made clear from the start of this administration that we would work to benefit all communities in all that we do.
Brenda Mallory chairs the White House Council on Environmental Quality at a ceremony today on the shore of the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. Now more on today's 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. We're joined on the phone by Darren Bax, the Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's with their Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment. Thanks so much for being here. I want to read you a bit of the proclamation from President Biden on this anniversary. He writes, "Before this landmark legislation, America's waters were in crisis, often flooded and even on fire with toxic pollution and cancer-causing contaminants. Industrial waste and sewage threatened our drinking water and wetlands disappeared at an alarming rate. The Clean Water Act met these challenges head-on, setting and enforcing national water quality standards, restricting pollution, and investing in wastewater treatment and better wetlands management." How do you see it?
Well, there was federal legislation before the Clean Water Act, and some might argue that the water was getting better, but there's no question that the water was a problem at the time, and nobody would dispute that 50 years on, water quality is better than it was then in 1972. But, you know, one of the things he doesn't mention was that a key aspect of the Clean Water Act is the concept of cooperative federalism, where the idea is that the states will play the lead role when it comes to protecting water quality. That was always the vision for the law. The law expressly says that right at the start of the law. And unfortunately, over the last, several decades, we've kind of lost that kind of concept. And instead, we've got the federal government kind of pushing out states and trying to dictate how we protect the environment when it comes to water. And I think that doesn't do a service for water quality and water protection.
Can you give a couple of examples of that happening?
Yeah, one of the most basic kind of questions is what waters are covered under the water under the Clean Water Act, and a definition that some people may have heard about is this question of what is the term navigable waters, and specifically what does waters in the United States mean? That's a definition that's in the Clean Water Act that's created a lot of controversy over the decades now, and it basically informs what kind of waters can be regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And what's happened over time is that the federal government has continuously tried to define almost anything you can possibly imagine. I might be exaggerating, but not completely, that they try to regulate almost every water. And what it does is it pushes out states and local governments from addressing these issues. And the federal government has got this big power grab. And what we want, and what you really want, is you want to have a more narrow definition, and then you want the states and local governments to play the prominent role in water protection, because the states and the local communities and property owners are closer to the issues. They know the specific problems that exist in their communities and with their waters, and it's better for them to address these issues as opposed to people in D.C. that are not as close to the concerns and how best to kind of figure out how to solve specific and concrete water problems that do exist.
That question you mentioned, what is a wetland? And I'm not surprised you brought that up, is just before the Supreme Court about a week and a half ago. Could we have a decision from the court affecting this soon?
Yeah. Exactly what you said, the Supreme Court is hearing a case as to what waters are regulated under the Clean Water Act. And as always, how broad and the opinion will be is unclear, and how much clarity the court will give us is unclear. But we're hoping that the court will provide clarity. I think regardless of what position you take on the issue, you want some clarity as to what is actually meant by waters of the United States. So, as you said, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments a couple of weeks ago. We would expect something, it would probably be one of the later opinions, probably in the spring of 2023, that we would get an opinion and hopefully get some clarity on what wetlands are covered, what waters of the United States means. And hopefully it does kind of create a scenario where it's more narrow in scope. And it's important to kind of recognize that just because a federal law doesn't create a regulatory scheme that's going to allow the EPA to dictate certain requirements, that doesn't mean the waters aren't protected. The waters are protected. Waters are protected through the states and the local governments. And some people might say, well, the states aren't doing it, or local governments won't do it. Well, I think that's a little bit of a negative view on what states and local governments would do. And that's certainly not what Congress thought in 1972 when they passed the Clean Water Act. They thought states would play the leading role. In fact, Congress said that the federal government should protect and preserve the state power to address water pollution.
We're talking with Darren Bax from the Heritage Foundation. More from the President Biden's proclamation on this anniversary. He writes, today we face serious threats to clean water, from climate change-driven droughts and rising sea levels to longstanding environmental injustices that have left too many communities without safe drinking water. Your response to that?
I think that what we need to be focused on right now, and specifically with the Clean Water Act, with Endangered Species Act, and other the landmark environmental laws, is a focus on concrete, specific environmental problems that people care about, like clean water, clean air, protecting species. And look, not everything doesn't have to always be through the prism of climate change. Environmental policy is not simply defined by climate change. What people want is they want clean water. When they swim in a lake, they want it to be clean. And what we want to ensure is that, again, that we're focused on specific concrete problems that then allow states to be able to address those issues. There's no speculation as to whether or not there's a problem. If there is, let's say there's a problem. And we want the states to kind of identify solutions to address those issues. And by having states be able to try to come up with their own solutions, we can kind of figure out the best practices that work to address problems that exist across the country. It's kind of this concept of the laboratories of democracy that states are supposed to be, where you kind of figure out, you know, the best solutions to the problems. And I think if we just kind of empower the states and local governments, property owners, to come up with the solutions to these problems and not micromanage it from D.C., I think we'll come up with some great solutions to real problems that do exist when it comes to water.
Darren Basks is with the Heritage Foundation, a senior research fellow. You can find his work at heritage.org and on Twitter at Darren Basks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the top stories Washington sent to your inbox every single day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.